IVM. Hello and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast. I am Saryu Natarajan.
And I am Alok Prasannakumar.
And in this week's episode, we discuss judicial appointments. We look at why judicial appointments have been so much of a bone of contention. We look at why these kind of conflicts arise, what it means in terms of politics, and how you could think of reform in this system. Yeah. And Alok's really the expert here. So it's going to be a little bit of me asking Alok questions about this issue. So to start with, before we even delve into some of these issues around the politics, could you just give us an overview of judicial appointments? Like, what does it mean? What is the process of appointment in the judiciary, and then where does politics intrude?
Right. So one of the fascinating things about the whole judicial appointments process is that it's possibly the most contentious provision in our constitution. Even during the time of the Constituent Assembly, there were huge debates as to who should appoint the judiciary, in what manner, whether it should be consent of the Chief Justice, no consent of the Chief Justice. And eventually we have the provisions that we have right now, Article 213 and 123. Of the Constitution, dealing with the High Court and the Supreme Court. For the moment, maybe we don't need to focus on subordinate judiciary, simply because there the process is done at the state level, and each state has a slightly different way of doing it, but broadly the same. The bigger fights have been over appointment of judges to the High Courts and the Supreme Court. And part of this has to do with the fact that our present High Courts, less the Supreme Court, are descendants of a particular set of kind of colonial institution. Mm-hmm. In terms of even the princely states would set up their high courts, try to model them as much as possible on the existing Bombay, Madras, Allahabad, and the Calcutta high courts. So there, those appointments are of course all done by the British. That didn't mean those judges were not independent. This is some of the interesting research that, say, someone like Abhinav Chandrachud has done. And this is a point that, so much of our fight over the judiciary happens is this, on this axis of independence, how independent our judges really are. So in a sense, you have to keep in mind that the judiciary was one of those institutions which most of our independence movement respected, or if they were not actively part of it, as lawyers or people who appeared in the courts and so on. So they really knew the value of an independent judiciary and wanted to try and create institutions and mechanisms to ensure that happens. What we have had since then is what George Gadbois, the American scholar who passed away recently, he in his book sort of talks about the three or four distinct phases in the appointment process. It's actually three, but maybe future historians will say what we are living in currently, say in the 2013-14 onwards, is maybe the fourth phase, and I'll leave listeners to figure that out. The first phase, so what our constitution says is very simple. Nobody's bothered amending it, and even that one amendment got struck down by the Supreme Court. So you have this process which very simply says that the president shall appoint the judges in consultation with the Chief Justice of India, the Supreme Court or High Court. In the first 20 years or so, this was what actually happened. You had Nehru for the bulk of it, and initially Indira Gandhi, basically go by whatever the Chief Justice of India then said they wanted to appoint, the High Court or Supreme Court. And you did, of course, the Governor and Chief Minister also involved for High Court judges. So there was some back and forth when it came to High Court judges, but Supreme Court judges, pretty much what the Chief Justice said went. Up to the time of Chief Justice Hidayatullah, when you had the Indira Gandhi government try to push a couple of names, and he simply refused. He said flat out, no, I'm not consenting to these names. After that comes a change. After that comes a change when you have Justice Sikri, S.M. Sikri, who takes over as Chief Justice of India, who sort of turns it a little bit, whether willingly or unwillingly, into a bargain. So he says, okay, you take two of my names, they give two of their names, and it becomes a back and forth. And this process continues into the 80s, when you have the third Indira Gandhi term, where you sort of see the government is now forcing names down the throat of this thing. And there's this whole response to the way in which High Court judges had stood up to the imposition of emergency. And there, the first pushback against this sort of starts coming through. You do have the judgment which came up in the 80s, the first judge's case, so to speak, where the Supreme Court largely upholds the practice as it stands, which is the government makes a recommendation and so on. But this runs into problems. And then in the 90s, we shift to the collegium system. Okay. So the collegiate system itself has two variations. Like the second judge's case creates the collegiate system, mostly because of this appointments crisis. You have a situation where the government is basically saying it's my way or the highway, right? A complete shift from the very first system that we had. This system of this bargaining sort of breaks down completely where the government basically says it's our way or the highway. Supreme Court, again, through a very, very creative interpretation of the Constitution, shall we say, creates the collegium. It says a group of judges will advise the Chief Justice. They didn't want this Chief Justice to be completely captured by the court or by the government to have a say in the whole process. So you have the collegium system. The collegium system undergoes a little bit of a change in 99 with the so-called third judges case, where they say that it'll be five judges instead of three. And in the context of high courts, it'll be three judges and they'll have to consult and so on and so forth. I mean, the details of the process I won't get into, but the shift being from just between the Chief Justice to the President, which is the ruling government, to some sort of a bargain between the Chief Justice and the government, to the government trying to push back and saying it's only our choice, to the collegium system where, you know, the judiciary feel that it has a role as an institution to respond to these appointments issues, you have a change in the system. Now, in 2014, a bill written during the UPA era is passed to amend this whole process and create a National Judicial Appointments Commission, which involves the law minister also in the process of selecting judges apart from quote-unquote eminent persons. And that is struck down by the Supreme Court in what is now being called the fourth judges case. But interestingly enough, the Supreme Court itself, especially Justice Kurien Joseph and Justice Chalamishar, who was in the dissenting but you know, sort of says it, they have a problem with the collegium system itself. And even the majority judgment does accept there are problems with the collegium system. And we can get that in the detail. So now we're left with this situation where the collegium, everybody is unhappy with the collegium. Let's be clear. In 2019, as this podcast is being recorded, everyone's unhappy with the collegium. Then the Supreme Court has acknowledged there are problems to it. But we're unable to break out of and create any kind of solution which tells us how to fix this appointment process.
So that's interesting. I mean, this issue of judicial appointment pops up ever so often.
Yeah.
Why is it a bone of contention? A lot of it has to do with, I mean, at least from the process side of it, it seems it has moved from different phases where there was some kind of consensus that was broken. And then there was a move to the collegium system and there's a proposal of the NJSC.
Yeah.
But why is it problematic? Why is appointing judges such a politically relevant topic? Like, why is it a hotbed and why should anybody care?
So the important thing is that for the first time in the Constitution 1950, judges in India could strike down laws, right? This was, of course, not the situation in the UK then. It's a situation in the UK now, to an extent. But you were introducing an American concept of judicial review of laws into what has hitherto been a common law, purely common law judge kind of system. And they did it consciously. They wanted the judiciary to hold a check. But they were kind of unhappy with the results. If you sort of see in the land reform cases, even though empirically Rajiv Dhawan in his book has shown that actually not that many major laws are struck down by the Supreme Court, it's actually the High Court that's got into the act. Instead of letting the judiciary resolve any contentious issues, the government's first response was to amend the Constitution. All right, you had Article 31 A, B, C, D, and then you had the very controversial ninth schedule introduced into the Constitution for laws which cannot be looked at by the judiciary at all. You had that dissatisfaction going, what is this? These British era judges don't know how to use judicial review. How dare they get in the way of this progressive, secular, you know, pro-people constitution, which was not theirs in the first place. You had that first level of dissatisfaction. But even then, there is still a sense that, look, okay, you know, judicial review is important. We may not like the results sometimes, but we can't entirely tamper with it. You have a completely different approach to it in the 70s. Now, you have a completely different generation of politicians who's come in. You have the Mohan Kumara Mangalams and you have the Krishna Iyers of the day who are very impatient with this judiciary, who are like, this judiciary is standing in the way of all of our important social reform needs. So when Indira Gandhi's bank nationalization and privy purse abolition gets struck down by the Supreme Court, it starts off a huge fight, right? And they're convinced. And because of the fact that one judge who was found in favor of the government was somebody who had very strong pro-Congress sympathies, or at least the Congress of the 60s and 70s sympathies, A.N. Ray, they feel the way out of this is we have to appoint more committed judges. That's the term. That's where the term sort of comes through. I think it was Mohan Kumara Mangalam who sort of came up with that phrase. And we need more committed judges for the country. And this is something that Indira Gandhi sort of buys into. And this is the genesis of the whole judiciary and the government fight, which revolves over the course of the 70s. There are, of course, limitations placed on the government's power to amend the constitution in the 70s. So you also have this particular response, which is to try and get our people, the right people, into the judiciary, even if it risks internally weakening the institution. So this created the kind of institutional feeling which led to the ADM Jabalpur judgment. And that sort of led to the Supreme Court itself coming up with PILs. And the next range of responses saying, how dare these judges interfere with our public systems of functioning? Who are they to question us on these points and so on? So which is why you see this constant back and forth. It's the fact that India's judges, India's Supreme Court judges, enjoy possibly the widest power of judicial review, that the government feels that it needs to control them in some way, need to sort of ensure the right people who enjoy, share the same thinking gets into the Supreme Court. And in that sense, it's not that different from the U.S. Supreme Court, let's be fair. In the U.S. Supreme Court as well, now we are seeing it so starkly that there are Republican judges who decide in a certain way. Like the cleavage in the U.S. Supreme Court, even between the 9 judges, is so stark and so revealing about the state of the politics there. It's possibly something to do with the fact that judicial review is something that we value. And therefore, it needs to, and this is where the government feels that we need to grab some power back from the judges by ensuring that people who think like us, who agree with us on our vision of the Constitution, should be there at the right place and the right time.
So, but how is this control affected by political parties or governments? Is post-retirement mechanisms one of the ways? Because it's all well to appoint a judge.
Yes.
But how do you enforce? Because your quote-unquote monitoring, I suppose, is really the real problem.
Yes.
And how do you do that in the case of judges?
Yeah.
Specifically in the context of the judiciary. Because judicial review in itself doesn't give itself to political solutions, to political answers. So how does this...
So that's the interesting thing. Like, in as much as we had so much debate in the Constituent Assembly on how to appoint judges, there's almost nothing about what happens to them after they retire. There's very little discussion about it. There was a certain unwritten political understanding that we won't tap into retired judges unless it's like some big issue. Like, I think Justice Chagla headed that commission which looked into that Jeep scandal during Nehru's time. And that became such a big thing when contempt proceedings had to be undertaken for the guy who said, Chagla, what does he know, and that kind of stuff. You never really had too much of a discussion. Like, what happens if every judge sort of starts seeing a post-retirement job as a given, all right? And the other thing that happens in the 80s is this tribunalization. And this is something that Anuj Bhuvania talks about in his book, like how tribunals were seen as a way to undermine the power of the high courts. That you take away a big chunk of the high court's jurisdiction by giving it to tribunals. Right? And where the government has no restriction who it appoints. There's no constitutional provision that says this is how to appoint judges or retired judges who it is to the Supreme Court. Sorry, to the tribunals. And in that respect, tribunals have become the way for the government to get judges to start acting in their way. So because, I mean, this is a sort of a point which Mr. K. Parasaran, whom I work with, sort of used to make. Like, look, why are you so obsessed with independence at the point of appointment? Because once that person is a Supreme Court judge, they may completely act in a way that you didn't expect them to. They may be the most loyal, most obedient person, but when they get to Supreme Court, they feel the powers that they have and change their mind about a lot of things. So there's no way to control it. It's this fact of post-retirement posts which sometimes affects that independence of it. Most interestingly, we now have, I mean, this used to be a matter of dinner table conversations or, you know, sly whispering in the court corridors, but now we have empirical evidence to show how judges' judgments are actually influenced by the prospect of getting a post-retirement position.
This is fantastic. What research is this?
So this is by Madhav Ane and a couple of other researchers. We'll post a link to this with this episode, who talk about, who sort of look at judgments delivered by judges towards the end of their judicial career, right? Like the last 2 years or so. And they only look at the significant judgments. They look at significant judgments by saying, you know, did the Attorney General appear? Did the Solicitor General appear? Did like senior advocates appear for both the parties and so on? And then for the other party, which suggests that this was some sort of an important case. Mm. It is not a run-of-the-mill tax case. It was not your run-of-the-mill service law case. They're unlikely to involve the Attorney General or Solicitor General for whatever reason. So you can be, it's more or less clear that if such major lawyers are involved, they pick the significant cases.
Did they look at government cases only?
Yes, okay. Yes. They look specifically at government cases. They looked at specifically at government cases with the Attorney General or whoever, central government cases. What they found was that as judges get closer to retirement, they start becoming more pro-government in their judgments. Like, this was measured. Interestingly, if that government had less than a year to go after their retirement, you didn't see those effects. Which means, unless you know that this government will be around for more than a year or at least a couple of years after my retirement, I'm not going to bother taking that favor because I don't know if they can return that favor for me, right? Because even the process, it's very rare when a judge goes straight from the Supreme Court to a tribunal. But it's because it usually has to be recommended by the Chief Justice and there's some process that goes on. They don't know if that particular promise will be met if, you know, they're not sure what will happen after the retirement. I use this as a way to save at least one judge's reputation, which is Justice Sadasivam, whom everyone accuses of letting Amit Shah go because he got the governorship of Kerala. Now, he sort of retired with, I think, the UPA government had less than a year in its tenure, definitely less than a year. And unless he was the greatest cephalologist in this country, he had no way of knowing who will come to power. Or even if he knew this government was going, that there's no guarantee the next government will look upon him favorably. So, which is why he possibly is not the best example of a judge giving this thing. But you will find so many other instances where judges start becoming more programmable. And we have a measurable way of doing this. Now, I and Deepankar's and other, I think Tan has named, they sort of go into much more depth with the data. And it's a very econometric driven piece. And it's called Corruption in Judiciary. We'll post a link to our system when it's there. But it's a fascinating example of how independence can be affected even after the appointment process. Like you may have the greatest appointment process. You may say absolute independence is ensured by this, of course. But when that reward is at the end of it, right, you will see that this particular judge can be influenced by the government to decide in a certain way.
Yeah, it's an incentive system. You can see the carrot ahead and decide accordingly. You might want to act in accordance with what the carrot entails.
Yeah.
But there's another sort of dimension to the politics of the judiciary, particularly around the issue of appointments. Does sort of the politics of judicial appointments also relate to who gets appointed within the judiciary?
Yes.
It is, and there's quite a lot of literature discussing that, you know, about how it's mostly men, upper caste, etc.
Yes.
But what does that mean, both in terms of how political it is, and what does it mean for outcomes and sort of broader questions of social justice?
Yeah, so absolutely right. And you have, again, Gadboy's book, which completely breaks down, like, Judges of the Supreme Court of India, 1952-1989, completely breaks down every single judge was appointed to the Supreme Court in this period. And others like Abhinav Chandrachud and so on have carried on this work to try and fill out the data to the latest point. But you will see almost a consistent pattern that the judiciary has been dominated. More than 80% have been men, upper caste men, and upper class also. That is, they had at least three generations of learning in their family. Initially, it used to, because the whole barrister system was very popular here, a lot of them got their education outside India. Now, less so, but it's still, the social profile remains the same. Now, of course, you have a few more women. At Supreme Court, as we speak, has about 10% women, but very little by representation of Dalits and even OBCs. Even though political space has opened up for OBCs, you find very little OBC representation among judges. Absolutely not to say nothing of, say, Adivasi judges or from other minority communities. And it's also sort of almost operates on a token quota basis, right? Okay, we have 2 to 3 Muslim judge quota in the Supreme Court, say, and we appoint people, 2 to 3 judges, never more, never less. We have a women's quota in the Supreme Court. We filled it up, never more, never less. We had one Dalit Chief Justice, but after him, till this year, we did not have a single Dalit judge in the Supreme Court of India. So we'll probably get another Dalit Chief Justice in 2025 because Justice B.R. Gawai will become Justice Chief Justice of India. So you have this system which is producing this extremely unrepresentative judges. And not that in a sense that you can't be a good judge if you're not from one of the excluded communities. It is just that the Supreme Court's outlook, the Supreme Court's vision of India is not, you know, it did not necessarily reflect the political movements. But it needs to at least reflect the diversity of lived experiences. You clearly see that there is a certain way judges think about issues like, say, death penalty, like the way they think about issues of women's rights. And, you know, we had this huge controversy blow up last year on the SCST Act, when they read it down and diluted the provisions. You had this controversy over the 498A, because, again, they read it down and diluted the provisions. Again, these are all two-judge benches where pretty much one judge's particular idiosyncrasies becomes the law. And that's not the way that the Supreme Court as a constitutional institution should be functioning. Ironically enough, the most diverse part of the judiciary is the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak. And this is some research that Vidhi has done, which we have on our website. you find more women, and almost every state has some provision for reservations for scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, meaning to say it is probably far, far more diverse than the high courts or the Supreme Court. But, and you think that, you know, with so many years of reservations and so on, so these are filtered up. It hasn't, because the collegium system actively discriminates against this group of people. I have written this piece in EPW in 2016, showing how there is an unstated but very clear cap on the number of judges who are promoted from the subordinate judiciary to the high court. It's about 30%. So the Supreme Court itself says repeatedly, no, at least 30%. But in the minds of the judges in the collegium system, it has become a ceiling. More importantly, there's another dimension to it. They're usually appointed so late in the careers that they never make it to the collegium themselves. They're never in decision-making in positions when it comes to appointments. So what inevitably happens is that you have upper class men who are advocates or senior advocates in that court, picking other upper caste men who are advocates in that court, perpetuating a permanent cycle. You will never be able to break out of that cycle because if the same kinds of people are picking the same, it becomes an old boys club, and that's very much true.
Hauntingly familiar. In so many of our institutions.
And unfortunately, that's exactly what we have seen in the Supreme Court as well, and in the judiciary at large as well, that you are essentially capturing this particular small section of Indian society has captured the judiciary, and we are left with a situation that is unhappy for everyone. The procedure is very non-transparent. And until recently, they didn't put out collegium minutes. Now that they do, there is at least some information. They're at least responding to it by making more information available. But we don't get a clear understanding of, okay, why is this person being considered? Is it just because they're higher up on the seniority list for perpetuating the old cycle? Or is it that there's something exceptional about them, some talent about them that we don't know? None of that is discussed. Like, the key decisions was why this person. And you had this caravan piece that's come out recently on how basic, and a lot of judges have already said it, the collegium meetings are a joke. They have no data about the judge. They've barely heard of any of these people. They simply go by, this person seems to be good or is high enough on the scene. And I think I've heard of him. I broadly know of him. They get these non-references from other judges of the same high court on this judge. And pretty much that person's opinion carries it. So you have a system which is non-transparent, not fair. It isn't leading to the best possible outcomes. But we've painted ourselves into this kind of corner, and which is sort of what my colleague at Vidhi Orgo's book deals with, that we've gotten ourselves into this corner where there isn't going to be a way out of this.
I guess also kind of hard to say that there is no way out of it.
Yeah.
In terms of thinking about solutions, I suppose, what could it be built on?
Yeah.
There's one element which clearly looks to be about breaking this hierarchy, but in what ways may that be done? Are there other sort of pillars that we need to think about in terms of bringing about change, even if it's incremental in this system?
Yeah. So we have seen an attempt to create a national judicial appointments commission, which has failed miserably. And the reason why I think it also failed miserably was because it sort of tried to bring back the second way of appointment, which is where it becomes a matter of bargaining between the judiciary and the government. In a sense, so the controversial part about the NJSC judgment is that it's legally unsound, right? Legally, you cannot really say that this judgment is perfectly valid. And again, lots of people, including my Vidhi colleagues, Orko and others, we've come up with a volume. It sort of talks about all the problems of the judgments. But politically, it was a problem that instead of reforming, you said, let's set the clock back to the 70s, right? Where the presence of the law minister and these eminent persons will allow us to bargain more effectively with you. So it was just like saying, okay, collegium is good. We have three people on your side, but we want three people on our side as well so that we can effectively bargain with you. And that is the worst way out of the situation. You're not really solving for the more serious problems, as I've just discussed. You're not solving the problems of lack of transparency, lack of fairness, lack of, you know, any informed decision making leading to non-representative judiciary. You're not solving for any of that. You're only solving for, hey, we don't get a say in this process. We want a say and on the part of the government. The way out, I feel, and this is something that I sort of said in a couple of other places, is to sort of take the kind of approach that other countries like the UK and a lot of African and South African and South Africa have taken, which is to have a much wider national judicial appointments commission. It can't just be left to a few judges and somebody from the government and unidentifiable eminent persons. You have to say, we're going to throw it open, where of course judges will be involved. Of course the government will be involved, but the public will have a say, right? You will have people from various walks of life. We will also set out criteria. we will say a person, of course, the basic minimum eligibility is there, but we will also have suitability criteria. We will say we want a person, you know, if you want to appoint to the Supreme Court, somebody between the age of 52 to 55 so that they have a long enough term on the Supreme Court. If you don't make this cut, you can, of course, be a very competent, very good Chief Justice of the High Court. But, you know, we will set out criteria that this is the judiciary that we want. We want a judiciary which is representative, which has this efficiency in the way it functions. We'll have a judiciary which is composed of the best legal experts, but is also capable of standing up to the government, which is also capable of being independent. So when you sort of decide this is the kind of judiciary that we want, you will then be able to design the appointment system accordingly. You will then realize, okay, look, you know, you can't just have this people choosing people from their own circles. We need to open it up for people from other sections of society. You need a mechanism which allows you to have the information about a judge, about what they've done in their judicial careers, and then, you know, sort of decide whether they're good or not, and have that transparency which allows people to have the confidence that, yes, the 15 most eligible and suitable candidates have become Supreme Court judges in the last 3 years or something like that. And people have an understanding that this process is not just open and transparent, not just, you know, representative, but it is open and transparent. You have confidence that this person can decide appropriately. So I think that is the kind of solution. It's just that, at the present moment, there is no real movement for this. There is a few people talking about what we should do, but within the government, or even within the large judicial legal fraternity, there is a sense that, you know, it's like a very unhappy marriage. We are both, you know, equally miserable with it, but it sort of kind of works for us. So let's just go with it, no matter how bad it may be for our kids or for other relatives or for our friends to be around us. So that's sort of what we are at right now. And who knows, maybe things might change in the next 4 or 5 years or so.
Well, I think that's all we have time for today.
You can let me go for another 45 minutes, but I don't think that's appreciate.
Maybe not even me.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I think, jokes apart, this is really indeed a serious issue. It's not, I guess, something that resonates in the everyday lives of every citizen,
right,
but something that has significant impact in the everyday lives of citizens because of how much power the Supreme Court and broadly the judiciary has,
yeah,
in the context of the power of judicial review. So thank you very much. It is weird to say to say thank you, but thanks. I think that was quite a great explanation around this issue. And we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week, and thank you for tuning in.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.